The last time Randall Balmer was on our show, he had just published the influential tome, Thy Kingdom Come, How the Religious Right Distorts the Faith and Threatens America, an Evangelical's Lament. I think it's fair to say a lot that's happened during the intervening years was foretold in that book. And now Dr. Balmer is back with his latest, Bad Faith, Race and the Rise of the Religious Right. The author, a religion historian, is well equipped to examine this issue from both outside and inside the modern American evangelical movement. And I am grateful this book brings him back to State of Belief Radio. Randall, thanks for being with us again.
It's always a pleasure, Welton. Thank you so much. Good to see you again.
Most people think they already know the foundational story of modern American evangelicalism. Critically, you challenge that narrative. So let's start right there.
Sure. Well, if we go way back to the 19th century, I think one of the things that I'm trying to point out is that evangelicals in the 19th century were very much on the side of those who were marginalized in the larger society. They were concerned with those Jesus called the least of these. And they did so in certain particular ways. The issue of prison reform, for example, support for public education, because they saw that as a way for those on the lower rungs of society to advance themselves. Very much in favor of women's equality, including voting rights in the 19th century. And of course, the issue of slavery. Now, I want to be clear, there were some many Southern apologists for slavery. I don't want to sugarcoat that or whitewash that, if I can use that term.
Yes.
But in the North in particular, evangelicals were very much concerned about issues of race and sought to end the scourge of slavery. And so you could juxtapose that with the contemporary political expressions of evangelicalism, and I think you find a rather stark contrast.
Why do you suppose this origin is not more widely recognized?
Well, I think the religious right is a very powerful media engine. And I think one of the reasons that people talk about the evangelical left or the religious left, and there certainly is such a thing, and I think you and I are both a part of that in one way or another, but we don't have media empires behind us. And so for decades now, the leaders of the religious right have been insisting that their movement started in opposition to the Roe v. Wade decision of January 22nd, 1973, to be particular about it. Yeah. And more comprehensively, they've been arguing that this is a movement that is concerned about the so-called reconstruction of American society or defense of so-called traditional values or family values or something like that, when in fact the origins of this movement have less noble origins, let's put it that way.
I understand. I'm glad you mentioned the slavery thing. The church that I was in, the evangelical church that I was in, unfortunately never mentioned slavery and certainly never mentioned the way in which black people were being treated. But there were others who did fight the slavery thing. How did we get from there to here?
It's a fairly sad story, I think. And I think as I look back as a historian, the crucial decade was the 1970s. And a lot of things happened in the 1970s, as I'm sure you probably remember yourself, as I do. One of them, in terms of evangelical political activism, was a rather remarkable document that was drafted by 55 evangelical leaders in November of 1973, meeting at the Chicago YMCA on Wabash Street. And they crafted this document called the Chicago Declaration of Evangelical Social Concern. And I invite your listeners to look at it for themselves. It's on the web. Make sure you look for the 1973 version of that document. But for me, it was a remarkable restatement and reaffirmation of the principles that had guided 19th century evangelicals and their social concern. That is to say, it decried the persistence of racism in American society. It talked about the growing gap between the most affluent and those who were on the lower rungs of society. It decried the persistence of militarism in American society. And it reaffirmed evangelicals' historic concern for women's equality. It was a remarkable document. Mm-hmm. So you have that in 1973. Then, of course, you have Jimmy Carter's rise to the presidency out of nowhere, really. A one-term governor of Georgia who unexpectedly kind of ascends to the Democratic nomination and then election of the presidency in 1976. And Carter, of course, was and is an avowed born-again Christian, a Southern Baptist Sunday school teacher who promised voters that he would never knowingly lie to the American people. And at that time, given Richard Nixon's proclivities in that direction, it was a radical idea that we would have a president who didn't lie to us. And then, of course, we come to the issue that I think you're, or the historical moment, which I think you're pointing to in your question. And that is the emergence of the religious right in opposition to Jimmy Carter, a born-again Christian, by the time of the 1980 presidential election. So I think the 1970s is a crucial moment for understanding contemporary evangelicalism and certainly the origins of the religious right.
You you highlight the shift in evangelical support to the GOP during the Carter era, and in fact, you're the author of a book-length profile of that evangelical president. I'd like for you to say another word or two about how all of this pivotal moment came about related to him.
Yeah, the turn against Jimmy Carter is something that I find – I remember at the time finding it – just kind of incomprehensible. Why would evangelicals turn against one of their own in a period of 4 years from 1976 to 1980? And I think there are a lot of reasons for it. Certainly, Carter was not, by many accounts, a successful president, although I would contest that, or at least much of that, because I think he was more, he deserves more credit than he has received. And historians, by the way, are finally coming around to understand that Carter was fairly effective in many ways. That said, it was a difficult time to be president with inflation going through the roof because of the Arab oil embargo, the taking of the hostages in Iran and so forth. So all of that figured into it. But at the same time, certain evangelical leaders, including, and I'm reluctant to say this because I admire him a great deal, Billy Graham. Billy Graham was working behind the scenes to undermine Jimmy Carter going into the 1980 presidential election. And to make a longer story a little bit shorter, what happened is that these evangelical leaders, people like James Robeson and Robert Billings and Jerry Falwell, coalesced against Jimmy Carter in the course of his presidency, and I want to underscore this, not because of Carter's position on abortion, because Jimmy Carter had a much longer and more consistent record opposing the incidence of abortion than did Ronald Reagan, who, as governor of California in 1967, signed into law the most liberal abortion bill in the country. It had nothing to do with abortion. What it had to do was the perception, and this was a flawed perception, but it was a perception nevertheless, that Jimmy Carter and the Internal Revenue Service were ganging up against these evangelical schools, such as Bob Jones University in Greenville, South Carolina, because of their racial policies. Mm-hmm. And that is really what lies behind the turning against Jimmy Carter by the 1980 presidential election.
Yeah. Well, today's political religious right coalesces around abortion and usually LGBT issues. Where does race play into their current agenda?
Well, I have to say that, Welton, that the 2016 election was a wake-up call for me when 81% of white evangelicals, and the modifier white is important here, decided to cast their political fortunes with Donald Trump, who, you know, I'm sorry, you can't make the case that he's an avatar for family values. Mm-hmm. You just can't make that argument. And I, like most of Americans, I think we're stunned by this. Mm-hmm. And what I determined, I think, in the course of writing the book, Bad Faith, is that the 2016 election allowed the religious right finally to circle back to the charter issue behind the formation of this movement. And because we haven't been explicit about it yet in this conversation, I want to make clear that the religious right did not coalesce as a political movement in response to the Roe v. Wade decision of January 1973. This is what I call the abortion myth. Mm-hmm. We got the religious right going, and I have, you know, the book, as you know, contains multitudes of corroborating evidence for this, and extensive footnotes, everything anybody would want to know if you really want to go back and retrace my steps here. The religious right began as a political movement to defend, and there's no pretty way to say this, to defend the racial policies, racial segregation at places like Bob Jones University and at so-called segregation academies, that is to say whites-only church-sponsored schools that had been formed to evade racial desegregation in public schools. Mm-hmm. That was the catalyst for the religious right. It had nothing whatsoever to do with abortion. Yeah. Evangelicals considered abortion a Catholic issue throughout the 1970s. Mm-hmm. So come back to your question. Mm-hmm. The embrace of Donald Trump in 2016, I think, and I want to be careful here, but it has, at the very least, overtones of racism. Mm-hmm. And again, we can revisit Donald Trump's rhetoric to talk about whether or not he's racist. And no one knows the inside of an individual, so I'm always reluctant to identify someone as racist. But at the very least, he invoked racist rhetoric in his campaign for the presidency in 2016, throughout his tenure in office, and again, of course, in the 2020 presidential election. Mm-hmm. And there was something in that rhetoric that appealed to evangelicals. And I also want to make clear that I've spent much of my life defending evangelicals against the charge of racism. Mm-hmm. After the 2016 election, I'm not sure I can do that any longer, at least not as vigorously as I once did.
Today's Evangelical Catholic Coalition is a conservative force to be reckoned with. Is the role of reproductive rights exaggerated by analysts of this development as well, do you think?
Yeah, I wonder if it is. I mean, I don't really know. It's hard to kind of enter into the thoughts and the motivations of people who are involved in this sort of thing. But at the very least, Welton, I would say that it has distorted things. I mean, you look at the Catholic bishops, and I've written about this in various times. The bishops now, of course, want to try to deny communion to Joseph Biden, who is a lifelong devout Catholic. And, I have to ask, in what moral universe do the bishops condemn Joe Biden and then at the same time fall all over themselves supporting Donald Trump? I mean, it just doesn't make any sense. Yeah. So at the very least, I think the issue of abortion, or as you say, reproductive rights, has distorted political categories and political alliances in our current political scene. And to anoint Donald Trump as a pro-life champion, again, given his history and given his personal circumstances, it defies understanding.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, just this week, we saw political candidates, notably in the Virginia governor's race, leverage the relentless outrage of the political religious right about critical race theory in the classroom. That certainly fits into the ongoing problems that you describe in your book, doesn't it?
I think it does. I think it does. And again, you know, one of the going back historically to the origins of this movement in the 1970s, Paul Weyrich, who's really the conservative activist who was the architect of the religious right. I mean, what he did in the course of the 1970s was brilliant. I would say devilishly so, but he was a brilliant tactician because he was able to shift the rhetoric away from a defense of racial segregation to a defense of so-called religious freedom, right? It's the Internal Revenue Service is trying to come in and tell us how to run our affairs. This is the rhetoric that was used. And he thereby wrote one of the pages in the contemporary religious right playbook. Oh, the government is trying to tell us what to do. All the while conveniently neglecting the fact that tax exemption itself is a form of public subsidy. Now, anybody who thinks about that for more than 30 seconds recognizes the truth of that statement. Yeah. Right? Tax-exempt organizations, of course, don't pay taxes. That means the rest of the citizens, the public, has to come up with the additional funds. Now, I'm not saying that's wrong. I think it's certainly defensible. Yeah. The founders understood the value of voluntary associations, and so I'm not condemning that. But to say that trying to enforce racial integration in evangelical schools is somehow a stepping on religious freedom, just as in the Hobby Lobby case or the Colorado Cake Maker case, it's indefensible, I think. Yeah. And frankly, for the Supreme Court to go along with that such crazy reasoning, I think, is a real travesty.
So, Randall, where does this leave us? are there places that you see where healing is happening? Are bridges being built in spite of the political expediency of ongoing racial manipulation? Or is it too late to stop the exodus from organized religion that politicizing it like this has triggered?
Well, I think your question is hitting on a very important point, and you know as well as I that there has been an exodus from religion, at least religious institutions. You have, of course, the flowering of this spiritual but not religious stuff that is all part of the rhetoric. I think if there is any hope, Wilton, for me, it lies with the younger generation. And certainly within evangelicalism, the younger generation is saying, wait a minute, you know, we have to examine our priorities here. We have to understand what's happening here. And by the way, I think the real wedge issue for the younger generation is the whole issue of climate change. And they understand the consequences of this because, of course, they have to live with it much longer than you and I do. And so they have a vested interest in it. But that I think, has been a kind of wedge issue. And I think once they begin questioning their elders, you know, our generation, then they begin questioning other things, particularly in the case of the religious right, the fixation on sexual identity, which really doesn't register with the younger generation. They just don't understand why this should be an issue, most of them, I think. Yeah. Or abortion, as we've been talking about. They're beginning to say, wait a minute, we need to look at this in a broader context and understand that there is a whole spectrum of issues that we might consider moral issues, including issues of poverty, the environment, as I said, equality, and so forth. You know, look at our immigration policies, particularly in the Trump administration. How do you square that with the New Testament? How do you square that with the Hebrew Bible? And the idea of welcoming the stranger, treating the foreigner as one of your own. Yeah. Now, it's those issues are complicated because you have to deal with issues of national sovereignty and so forth. I understand that. But just to deliver these sort of blanket condemnations of anyone who doesn't look like we are, I think a younger generation recognizes that as being inconsistent with the teachings of Jesus. Yeah. So that's where my hope is.
Dr. Randall Balmer is a religion historian, college professor, prolific author, and ordained pastor. His powerful new book is titled Bad Faith, Race, and the Rise of the Religious Right. Randall, it's been great to have you back. Thanks for taking time to be with us today on State of Belief Radio.
It's my pleasure, Wilton. God bless.
That's all the time we have for this week's show. Your donations help keep us on the air. Information on how to donate is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Be a part of the conversation. Social media helps connect like-minded people in conversation and company. I'd ask you to share State of Belief with just one person this week for whom you think this might be helpful. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. Yes, he was. He was.